session number 22677, reel 1.
Jeff Rees, reel 1. Where were you born, please?
Birmingham.
Which year was this?
1921.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Birmingham?
Yes.
Which school did you go to there?
King Edward's Grammar School, Five Ways.
Which part of Birmingham did you grow up in?
Oh, various parts. It moved. I was born in Edgbaston, I think it was. We moved from there to Worley. Then from there we moved to Harbin. Then we moved to Handsworth Wood.
How old were you when you finished school?
17.
So that was in 38?
Well, I suppose I was 16, actually. I was 17 about a month after I left school.
So. Did you get a job on leaving school?
Oh, yeah.
Doing what?
I was a clerk in an insurance, at a friendly society.
Is that what you were doing when war was declared?
No, I left that and I worked then for the City of Birmingham Estates Department, controlling all the council properties.
Did you join any organisations pre-war, like TA?
No. When the war started, I went in the ARP. I was a dispatch rider in the with a heavy rescue and ambulance section during the Blitz on Birmingham in 1940.
On a motorbike?
Yeah. My own motorbike. I had a motorbike in 38, but I left school, I bought one.
What kind of motorbike did you buy?
Oh, I had a 250 New Imperial.
So, you were a keen motorcyclist?
My brothers were, you see, and so was I. It was freedom. Go anywhere, you see that. As long as I could afford the petrol, I went.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Oh, yeah.
How did you feel about that?
Well, excited, I suppose. I mean, at the age of 18 or so as I was, they didn't worry much about anything, except how to pay for the petrol tax and the that sort of thing. Nothing much worried you at 18, you know.
Did the war affect you at first?
Petrol rationing was what affected me. I couldn't get so much petrol.
How much could you get?
Well, I've gotten now. Not a great deal. But then, of course, when the Blitz started, you got petrol allowance from the ARP, and also from my employers, because when the house was being bombed, they had to employ firms of furniture removers to go to the bombed houses and recover as much furniture as possible and take it to storage. And I was making the inventory of the furniture coming into these storage places, old churches and warehouses and things like that. They used storing all the bombed furniture.
Whereabouts did you go to?
What do you mean?
Which parts of Birmingham?
Any part. Anywhere.
All over the city?
Hmm. Hmm. Yeah.
Were you in any bombing by the German Air Force?
Ah, yeah. Well, we went, a friend and I went out to judo one evening. And came back down. Do you know Birmingham at all?
I've been there to do interviews.
Well, it's a big road called Broad Street, goes into the middle of the town from Five Ways into the centre. And I was riding down there, and they started dropping incendiaries on the road. And I was steering around these incendiaries, quite, you know, getting out of the way. Then I ended up in a bomb crater later on. Fell into a bomb crater, but it didn't hurt the bike, so I got round and went and carried on.
Was it frightening?
Well, not particularly. It was exciting. I mean, at the time you don't realise the dangers, you see. It's only when you realise the dangers you're frightened. It was like bonfire night more than anything else.
Was there much damage being done to Birmingham at the time?
Oh, yeah, well, yes. I don't want to. I don't think by where I lived in Handsworth, you see, my depot was in Handsworth itself, the heavy rescue place, and we had to go out with them to rescue the people who were trapped in the bomb buildings. And one place was down where I used to go to school as a small boy down up at the George Dixon School. Some houses there were bombed, they were flattened completely. And I mean, you see things then that you would never expect. I mean, There was a bundle of rags lying in the gutter, you see, as we thought. And when it got dawn, we realised it was the body of a girl. No head, no arms, nothing. A terrible thing to see. Makes you realise the war's all about then.
Who had to deal with the bodies?
Pardon?
Who had to deal with the bodies?
Well, it wasn't us. I mean, the ambulance people would do that, but they'd walk us there with the living ones, you see. Getting them out, shoring up the timbers, and getting the injured ones out. Oh, yes. Another lot there. There was, up in Handsworth, there was a shop there with a big cellar underneath. They turned it into an air raid shelter, but when the bomb came down, it burst the water mains and blocked it, and they were all drowned inside it. About 20 of them.
Did you visit that scene?
I didn't see it. I saw it afterwards.
What did you see?
Well, I didn't see it. I just saw the building. I didn't go inside to look. I mean, they'd all been taken away by that time.
What was your address at this time?
Oh, in Handsworth Wood. 113 Cherry Orchard Road, where I lived.
Did any bombs fall in that street?
No. It was further out, you see. Further out from the town centre. The worst thing, there was the anti-aircraft guns in the park behind us that used to blow the doors and windows open when they fired.
Did they do much damage?
What, the anti-aircraft guns?
Yes.
No. They blow the door open, you see. The door had been locked. And they come down, they might find the door wide open. Just sprung apart.
So the lock wasn't smashed?
Oh, no. There were cracks and so on in the ceilings, that sort of thing, but nothing serious.
Did you use air raid shelters?
I didn't, no. My parents had one of these steel things in the room.
What Morrison shelter?
I forget which is which now. We didn't have a thing down the garden, the iron thing. It was too cold and damp, those things were. But had one in the room, so went underneath it. Well, it formed a table, really. Like a big rabbit hutch. You sort of crawled inside this thing. But I never went there because I was out, you see. When the air raid started, when I went off to the depot.
How did your parents cope with the bombing?
I don't know, I suppose they were lucky they weren't hit, you see. They were lucky they, I mean, it didn't affect the outlying suburbs very much. It made it the centre of it, further in.
Was there any hatred of the Germans who were carrying out the bombing?
Oh, yeah. I've forgotten a lot of this about what happened, like, you know. But, yeah. Oh, yes.
Did you think they might win the war?
Well, not then. A bit later on, we did. By that time, of course, France was, well, we were on our own completely. There was nobody. We had no allies apart from Canada and Australia, so I think we couldn't do much. There was a strong possibility, but we didn't really think about that. Because there's not much point thinking about it. Not much you could do if it happened. In the following year, 41, I went in the army. And then because I was could ride a motorbike, in the motorcycle magazine they advertised that motorcyclists who passed their tests and so on could join the Royal Corps of Signals as dispatch riders, directly entering. It's volunteers, you see. And I thought it would be a good way of passing the time. No tax, no insurance, free petrol. And my father, he hadn't been fit enough to go in the trenches in the First World War. He'd been in the depot at Warwick, the Royal Warwickshire Regiment. And he told me they were at the receiving end of all the effects of the people who had been killed. And his advice was, don't go in the infantry, he said. So I thought I'd make sure of that by going in the signals.
How did you go about it?
Well, I volunteered, you see. And they had a note to go and have a medical examination, which I did. And a few weeks later, I had to travel once to report to the 4th Division in Winchester. Signal Section, 4th Division. Well, I got there, 13th of March, 41. With five of us, all sort of volunteers, all could ride motorbikes, we'd go in there. And we were trained to be soldiers. We'd all ride, it is. I didn't have to teach us how to ride a motorbike, but they had to teach us how to salute to get our pay and how to do a rifle drill so we could go on guard and things like that. And, of course, the uniforms were very short in 1941. They were still replacing the stuff that had been lost in Dunkirk, you see. So we didn't. So we spent the first fortnight or so wandering around half in half military, half in khaki and half in civilian clothes, so I could get us out properly. Then we had a corporal who, the Lions section, taught us how to do rifle drill. Because we hadn't got, DR don't have rifles, you see, they have revolvers. So he taught us how to handle a rifle. We had a salute, they had a march. One of our chaps couldn't march. he used to swing his left arm with his left leg. And of course, when he started to march, he upset everybody else. It was most peculiar. So I had to make sure he was on duty somewhere when they had any inspections or any marching he had to do.
Did he eventually learn?
I don't think so, no. No, I never bothered. Just then go on do the duty when somebody else came to see us.
Oh, what?
No, it's funny to see a line of him going along with left arm and the whole lot of disintegrate. You can never coordinate it. But I say it taught us how to. We became DRs. Three grades of DRs. You see, a DR D3 is the lowest grade of all. We had to pass a trade test to be able to ride a motorbike and a few things like that, which we got quite easily. And a D2, you had to be able to read a map, you know, from like all the points, numerical, what do they call them?
The six-figure grid reference?
Grid reference, that's right, from a grid reference, you had to find a place like that. And you had to be able to learn how the line section worked. They thought that we, as DRs, would go along and look for loose. So the telephone cables were broken, we stopped and repaired them, things like that. A bit silly, wasn't it? So they taught us how to repair telephone cables, because you've got a done 8 cable. You've got 8 steel cables and 1 copper, you see, in a telephone cable, like military wires. So you had to bend the copper wires, so the copper wires are what carry the current. The steel wires merely for strength. So you have to get the copper wires and twist them together, you see. So they taught us how to do that.
Just marry the two ends together.
The coppers, you see, to get so the. I don't know why they thought we were going to stop looking for telephone wires that were broken. There were hundreds of telephone lines lying around. But anyway, that was that. And then had to show you a map, you see, and describe, and you'd take it away. They say describe a route from A to B, what you'd find on the road. You see, where you turn left, turn right, over a railway crossing, up a hill or down a hill, and that sort of thing. So you could find that way without a map, you see, once having seen it. Which is very useful. We never saw any maps after that. Only in the signal office. There aren't many maps about, you see, when you're moving. If the memory, you have to remember them. So I taught us how to do that sort of thing, and became a D2, like all the rest of them. This unit, I mean, the 4th Div, was a territorial unit, you see.
What was it called?
4th Division. Well, 4th Infantry Division. They'd been at Dunkirk and come back, but the chaps there were nearly all territorials, you see. And we got very well with them, because they saw we were more or less the same as them, you know, all volunteer sort of thing, and we were not regulars. Nobody liked the regulars. They were the laziest ones going, they were. And the new recruits, of course, couldn't ride a motorbike for toffee. They didn't know how to do it. It took about a year to learn how to ride a motorbike. But we were okay, you see. We were just fitted in. Well, there were 5 of us, and then we gradually got whittled down, you see. In the end, I think there was only 1 bloke left, I think, in the 4th Div at the end of the war. The rest of us all gone our separate ways.
Were you attached to the divisional headquarters?
Yeah, that's part of the Div headquarters. We provided signals with that throughout the division, you see.
So you were training in the Winchester area, were you?
Yeah, we were guarding the south coast, Bournemouth, Southampton. That was our stretch of coast. We defended that.
Did you think the Germans were going to invade?
Well, it was always a possibility. We had to go around armed all the time. We had to take your revolver with you or rifle all the time at certain points.
A revolver or a rifle?
Well, we have revolvers. The other chaps have rifles, you see, the operators. So we had to be armed all the time in case anything did happen.
What kind of motorbike did the army provide for you?
Oh, had a BSA 500, 6 side valve, the usual thing. And mostly all through the war, BSAs. Yeah, a good old bike, very reliable. Yeah.
So you had a very powerful bike?
Oh, it wasn't powerful, no. Maximum speed was only about 70. Wouldn't do more than the very low compression things, you know. When the petrol was only just over 75 octane. Very low powered.
Did you like doing the job?
Oh, yes, I loved it. I wouldn't have done anything else. It was the best job in the army. You had freedom, you see, doing that. You They give you a bit of paper, they take it here, off you go, and come back hours later, be on your own. You could wander around on the way back. See all sorts of things that nobody else ever saw, you know.
Any incidents that happened to you at this time?
Well, not particularly one. A bit hairy and grip dry. We had to go through the New Forest in pitch dark, you know. We had to go down to Ringwood and on to Bournemouth, back to Winchester. In the middle of the winter there, in the dark and the rain, it wasn't very pleasant. One chap got kicked by a deer, I think it was, one night. They hadn't got the fences alongside the road in those days because the deer wandered all over the road. Because you already got on the motorbike, there's a little cowl over the headlamp, a little spotted light in front of you. So at about more than about 25 miles an hour, you're going blind. No, it was all very, very nice. I mean, boring in a way. It was routine, you see. I mean, some chaps had a much more boring life than that, but at least we got out. We were able to get around a bit. Went to going to Southampton. Saw a plane, like how bombed that was. That was a real mess.
How did it compare with the bombing in Birmingham?
Well, it's much more concentrated in Southampton. Do you know Southampton at all?
A bit.
You know where the bar gate is, do you?
Yes.
Well, from the bar gate down to the front, it was completely flat. Every building was flattened completely. There wasn't anything standing. Above the bar gate, there were a few little bits and pieces, you know. Remains of buildings were still occupied, but beyond that, it was absolutely flattened. I don't think any part of Birmingham was quite flattened that way. Of course, the bombing in Birmingham wasn't so severe as, say, Coventry. You see, there was nothing to guide that. The bombers would come over. You'd hear them coming over, you see, at night time. You could see them at night time, on a moonlit night. You could see them coming across the moon, across the sky. You could tell by the noise they made. Their distinctive sort of noise these German bombers made. But they didn't. They had no guidelines, nothing to guide them. There's no river, no guides, you see. Nothing that they could see in the moonlight, just a vast mass. And they used to have smoke generators towards the end, puffing out clouds of dirty, filthy smoke, made like a fog, so you couldn't see a thing at all. They used to bomb through it. But they were not as concentrated as some towns.
What are your next memories in the war?
Well, going abroad. We went from Aldershot, we went from Winchester, we moved to Aldershot. We were always being threatened with embarkation, you see, because we had four embarkation leaves, which is very nice. And we went to Aldershot, so all together, not scattered there, all together. Because I think that was in the end of 41. Some other division took over from us in Winchester. We went to Aldershot. And then we moved to Scotland. Well, I think Scotland wasn't defending, but we ended up there. It was Ayrshire. You know, we were in Dumfries, and the division was all around the southern part of Scotland there. And from there we went to Port Glasgow one day and got on board a boat. Took us off to Algiers.
What was the voyage like?
Well, I wouldn't like to put me off ships for life, that did. We went... We were supposed to hold 3,000, we were told. There were 6,000 of us on board this old Greek ship. And we were down at the very bottom. You know, where the walls are, where the sides are coming in like that.
Sloping down.
Yeah, below the waterline. And we had a hammock each. And when the hammocks were slung up, you couldn't walk. You had to go on your hands and knees to get out, to go to the loo, something like that. Underneath all the other hammocks. We had 10 days of that.
Do you know the name of the ship?
No idea. He went east for about 3 days and then sort of curved round and went west for about 3 days, then curved round and came east then. You see, it was through the Straits of Gibraltar. And the night I bombed a torpedo the ship next to us one night. We were lying down there, the thump that was the ship next door to us had it, you see. You got the torpedo and we didn't. Yeah. So we landed in Algiers, and usual naval cock-up, the transport had gone to Beja, which is about 200 miles further on the coast, and we had landed in Algiers. And they were pretty good at landing you in the wrong places. We're laughing. I said, I think on the television recently, I landed the vintage water on the landed them in Spain instead of Gibraltar. They were good at that. But anyway, they landed us in Algiers with no transport. So I had to go in the back of the load of 3 tonners over the Atlas Mountains to get to Béja. Then pick up our transport there and then go down to the front line.
What impression did Algiers make on you at first?
Well, most of it was out of bounds anyway. Well, it's a foreign country, I mean, full of wogs. We were some miles outside, we only saw it once or twice. It was only there a few days. Didn't see much of it, really.
So this
was no transport to get into it. You have to walk about 7 or 8 miles to get to the place. No transport at all.
So this was well after it had been captured?
Oh, yes, yeah. This was in the... we sailed from Port Glasgow on March the 13th. So we must have got there about the 23rd, I suppose, 10 days later. 23rd of March. By that time, you see, the war in North Africa was drawing to a close pretty well. So we were sent there in the it finished in the May, I think. And we didn't get to the front until about April, beginning of April. So we only had about 6 weeks of it in action there.
What happened once you got to Béja?
Well, the trucks picked up the vehicles. Well, the vehicles were brought down to Medjez, and we were taken to Medjez El Bab, and the trucks took the vehicles there. The vehicles were taken down to us. All the motorbikes were in the back of trucks, you see. So then we saw a bit of action there for about a month or so, and then it was all over. Tunis was captured, that was that.
What's happened to you in the front line?
Nothing much. It was quite easy. Nothing much different to ordinary routine manoeuvres, you know.
Weren't you in any danger from the enemy at all?
No, more danger than the American Air Force. One of our chaps went back to see his friend about 12 miles back and they bombed him there. The Yanks were good at bombing the wrong side, you know, they couldn't tell. You saw any airplanes around and they got American stars and went for cover. They're worse than the Germans very often. There were more of them.
And so you never got attacked by German aircraft?
We saw them, but we got down quick. No, they didn't attack us. There weren't many of them by that time, you see.
How did the local people behave towards you?
Locals? There weren't any. They'd all got out of the way. The locals all disappear when the fighting starts, you know. They're either taken away or make their own way out of it. They want to avoid being involved in it. In the back of Tunisia, it's very empty country anyway. There are no houses, something like very, very few. We were fighting like in a desert.
So you were operating in the Medjez El Bab area?
Well, from that was the beginning. We went on to other places further along, which haven't really got any names. Yeah. No, it didn't really matter very much what happened.
Any stories of what happened to you in North Africa?
No. Well, as the traffic went along, it widened the tracks, you know. They found one day riding over a German corpse. That the road had widened, you see. It had been buried in the verge originally, only a shallow grave. As the roads were widened, they went over, finally riding over him. Bit gruesome.
Did they remove the body?
I don't know. Wasn't their job to remove bodies. Just get out of the way quick. The special section did that sort of thing, you know. I don't think anybody bothered them. We were only there for a day or two and we moved on further on, you see.
What were your living conditions like in North Africa as compared with England?
Oh, well, no comparison at all, is there? When you go overseas, you have to find your own shelter very often. And we have little two-man bivouacs. The thing about this high...
About three feet
high, with a mosquito net around one end, you see. And two, we're supposed to camp, live in that.
Like a ridge tent?
Yeah, that's right, a little ridge tent, about 3 foot high. Hey, you could try and imagine two blokes trying to struggle into one of those things at night time. The mosquito had to get the mosquitoes out.
Did you suffer much from mosquito bites?
No, we had to... We had to take his little Mepocrine, I think Mepocrine, the yellow pills every day. little yellow, tiny little things handed out as you get your food. You have to have one of those things as well before they gave any food. I know water was very short, of course. One day we hadn't got any water. We were very short of water. And we all came back. About 10 of us had a... We washed out a tin. Because the biscuit tins you have about that square, like that, and about that high, you see. So we cut the top, cut them halfway down to make water containers to wash in. The 10 of us, we washed our hands and face in this tin of water, first of all. It was really a bit thick by then, so we then washed our feet in it. Then we washed our socks in it. It was almost solid by that time.
Did you have enough to drink?
Oh, well, yeah. Yes. Well, drinking was the main use for water, not for washing. I didn't bother about washing yourself, drinking it. They had a horrible taste with the... what's that stuff they put in water to purify it?
Sterilising tablet?
Yeah.
Chlorine?
Chlorine, that's right. Chlorine in the water. Yeah, terrible stuff. But the Germans were far better. We found what they had. They had chlorine tablets. And then the tablets take away the taste of the chlorine. And we found that we used them then. When we found out what they were. Of course, at the end, when the war finished there, the Italians, the Germans all surrendered, most of them anyway, surrendered. The Italian quartermaster drove up to our part and surrendered with his van full of all his food. Which was great, that was. Because the Italians didn't want to have a war anyway. They were only too happy to give themselves up. A lot of the Germans went into hiding with the Arabs, because they had promised the Arabs freedom, you see, from the French. The Germans were going to give the Arabs independence. And, of course, the Arabs liked that idea. And they looked after the Germans when they were defeated. Because we had the job of rounding them all up afterwards. Cape Bon, there's a British city called Cap Bon. A lot of the Germans went up there, you see, because they couldn't get across the straits. There were no boats for them. And they dressed as that. The Arabs took them and dressed them, you see, as Arabs. So, of course, you find red-headed, blue-eyed Arabs around up there. Had to go searching for them. Oh, the Arabs were all right. Of course, they were grave robbers, but apart from that, we didn't know much to do with them.
Did you have any experience of their grave robbing?
We used to hear about it, because you see, you bury a body in a blanket. And the Arabs valued blankets very highly, so they used to dig them up and pinch the blanket. If you saw an Arab around, you shot him. That was the theory, anyway.
Did you ever see that?
No, I never saw that. You used to hear all sorts of stories, I mean. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I say, after the war was over there, we then invaded. The 4th Div had to provide recruits for the 1st Division. The 1st Division had lost a few on the way, sickness and that sort of thing. So 6 of us had to leave the 4th Div signals, the DRs section, and go to the 1st Div, who were just along the coast from us.
In North Africa?
Yeah, that's right. So, just threw our name out by out of the hat. 5, 6 of us had to go, and that was that. So 6 of us trundled off to the 1st Division, 1st Infantry Division.
To their divisional headquarters?
Oh, yeah, they're all Div headquarters, yeah. Yeah.
When you were with the 4th Division, which infantry units were you particularly operating with?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know the army organisation? You've got a division, normally has three brigades. Each brigade has 3 infantry battalions and a field regiment and so on. So in a division there are 12 different regiments, 12 different battalions, you see?
So you worked with them all?
Well, we didn't go to the, we only went as far. The divisional headquarters operates a signal between the div headquarters and the brigade headquarters. The brigade headquarters signals goes from then down to battalions, you see.
So you were just working from division to brigade?
Division to brigade, and all the other units associated with it, you see. Field regiments, medium regiments, heavy ACAC, and all the rest of them, you see, anything like that. It was attached to the div. Anybody in their area.
Did you get the impression that any of the brigades were better organised than other brigades?
Well, the 1st Division, you see, had the first... It was a regular division, all boneheads, you see, all regulars. And they had the First Guards Brigade. And it was unbelievable what they used to do. They used to make them shave before they went into action, so when they were killed, they were clean shaven, see? They'd come out of action, the first thing they'd do is polish all their brasses. When they go back into action, they make them all dull again, you see? Take all the blanco off. Well, bullshit, isn't it? It's all they ever lived by. They were complete boneheads. They did what they were told. They were so drilled, they were told them and they did it, without question. Oh, it's all right, I suppose, in certain circumstances, but it wouldn't have suited me, for instance. Anyway, six of us went off to this first division. They were where all the two.